This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 419 for May 4th of 2018. Steve Miller on Tesla, Ford, and being a supplier. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to Autoline After Hours, especially Mr. Gary Vasilash.
How are you doing, John?
I'm doing pretty good. I always tell you that. I never tell you, oh, life sucks and I've about had it. I always tell you it's great.
I'm glad to hear that, because otherwise we might have to call in for some help, but we won't need that today.
We got to tell everybody that Todd Lassa is back in the house. Todd Lassa with Automobile Magazine. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, John. Always good to be here.
Always good to be here. And our special guest for today is Steve Miller, the president and the CEO of a company called IAC, International Automotive Components, but a guy who's got an incredible amount of experience in this industry. And Steve, it is awesome to have you back here.
Well, thank you.
So I don't know where to start this thing. Let's start with some of the news. You used to work at Ford.
Yes.
You worked years at Ford. You worked for Lee Iacocca at Ford. You worked with Lee Iacocca at Chrysler. Ford, as you know, just announced it's pretty much going to whack all its passenger cars in the U.S. market. What do you think about that?
First off, they are responding to the market, and they are going to put their money where you can make money. I have, you know, a bit of sadness about this simply because, A, it was the first company I ever worked for was Ford, and secondly, it's part of the history of the automobile business. By having brought out cars that everybody could afford and transport their family around in, and for them to say, okay, we're just going to get out of that business is, you know, still a little bit of a shocker I'm trying to get over. But I don't blame them. They need to go where they think they can make money, and if the small end of the car business has gotten to be unprofitable, then on behalf of your shareholders, you shouldn't be pouring money into it.
But what do you think about companies like Toyota and Honda and Hyundai going, hey, we're not getting out of the car segment. We think this is a great, viable segment. Why can they do it and Ford can't?
Well, Ford, you know, does have some inherent cost disadvantages compared to the non-Detroit
like the UAW players. Especially?
Yeah. I was hoping not to say that word, but
you've had your run-in with the union in your past.
Oh, yeah. We had to deal with it at Delphi, and it was a brutal period. But the extra cost that is brought by the UAW arrangement, and a lot of people focus on just the pay scale, the take-home pay. That's not where it's at. It's all in the benefit structure, the early retirement structure, the health care structure, and everything else that characterizes UAW contracts versus others. So that's one big problem. And the other thing that people don't look at is the productivity inhibitors that are inherent in a UAW contract. It takes a lot more people to operate a plant if it's UAW than if it's non-union.
Because of work rules and lines of demarcation.
Yeah, job classifications, everything else. There was a lot of cleanup that was done 10 years ago with the crash in the auto cycle, but there still is a residual overhang of what used to be when the UAW had a monopoly on the business of making cars for the American public, which at that time was the biggest market in the world. So Ford's still having to live with that, but you've also got the government CAFE rules, means you've got to give away the small cars to earn the credits so you can sell larger, and yet the government also maintains a policy of very cheap energy, low gas prices. And guess what? You have created a situation where the manufacturers are essentially at war with their customers over the product mix that they can sell. I mean, there's no magic that allows you to create vastly many more miles per gallon out of any particular vehicle. The way you make the target is to have an average that gets more miles per gallon, and the way you get there is sell smaller, lighter vehicles. But if it's cheap gas, the public doesn't care about lighter vehicles. give me something with a lot of room to haul things around.
Well, plus if you do it as on a percentage basis, right, if you have to get 5% gain over a period of time, a year or whatever, it's harder to get 5% out of a car that's already getting 35 mpg versus a truck that's getting 20, right?
Exactly right.
So, and if I could ask, when you talk about the energy policy, I'm guessing that maybe you're with a lot of people in the U.S. industry that would rather see a higher gas tax versus a CAFE sort of arrangement?
Totally. I mean, when I wrote my book, I talked about gas taxes being, you know, the right answer. And it's everybody looks at Europe. How come Europeans are so smart and buying, more fuel-efficient vehicles? Well, if your gas price is $10 a gallon, of course you care about the fuel economy. Here, where it's about $2, maybe going to $3, give me that big SUV.
You know, to the point of Ford, Steve, I'm wondering, though, that, okay, if we look at Toyota, last month they sold about 70,000 cars, not trucks and SUVs, just cars. And Ford sold about 40,000 cars. Okay, so you got a 30,000 delta there. So isn't it conceivable that there's more money to be had by actually offering a suite of cars, in addition to which having vehicles that people can come into your brand as an entry level versus what, you know, the average even small SUV costs?
Yeah, well, 80 years ago or whatever, that was the General Motors plan. They did it by having brands, so you could come in at the Chevrolet end, and then later when you were rich and famous, you could buy a Cadillac. And it was a great strategy. And the same thing would apply here. When you're young, start with a small, much cheaper, more affordable vehicle, and then as you go up the income scale, gradually move up. So there's a strategy there, but it just takes a hell of a lot of investment and fortitude to continue to work at it. And Ford Hackett just said, I give up. Let's put our money where our mouth is. And a little bit of history here, and that is back when I was working for Iacocca at Chrysler, at around 1990 or so, I wrote a memo and I said, hey, Lee, we're making all of our money on Ram pickups, minivans, and Jeeps. And then we lose half of that trying to make cars. How about we just dump the cars and focus on the things that make money? And so I was mentioning that last year to Marchione, and he says, yeah, I got the memo, and I did it. And now Ford, apparently, take another page from that playbook. But it's, these are companies who are following the customer and doing what the customer wants and where they can profitably invest to do that.
Well, but too, don't they? Following the customer, that's one thing, but when you see that, you can make, you can charge, say, Fusion prices for a Ford Escape, and the Ford Escape doesn't cost that much more to build than a Ford Focus, you're going to be advertising, marketing the Escape a lot more. Isn't it kind of a two-way street where, you see what the customer wants, but if you see that there's a profitable advantage to that product, you're going to be pushing it a little bit more.
Well, I think there's, you may be right. And if you've got unlimited investment funds to spread around, but if you look at where the car companies are now, they are looking at huge investments to make sure they don't get left behind on autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles, electric vehicles, and so on. And so I'd be saying, how many different models and brands do I want to carry versus focusing my investment on what's going to be winning in the future? I mean, I'd be really running scared if I were a big car company today.
Because of those, the electrification and the autonomy?
Yeah.
So do you think that that'll have an effect on the overall fleet of vehicles that are sold on an annual basis?
Well, people question it. If you have shared rides and so on. But when I look at it, suppose nobody had a car in the garage. They just did all shared vehicles. Those vehicles are going to be on the road maybe 10 times as much as a privately owned vehicle that spends most of its time in the garage. That means they're going to wear out in one-tenth the time. I mean, because there's a limit to how many miles a car can go before it needs to just be replaced. And therefore, you know, a car may be getting a lot more usage, but it's also going to wear out sooner, which means the replacement cycle is going to be pretty close to where it is today, I would guess.
See, I don't agree completely. I used to think that, but I believe the industry is going to have to change its test cycles and duty cycles. And today, you know, everybody designs their cars to last 150,000 miles. I mean, you can get them to last longer than that, but that's what the test cycle is for, 150,000. I think it's going to have to go to a million. It's going to have to be like Class 7 and 8 semi-trucks. And because if I'm a mobility company, to your point, and this car is going to be on the road 10 times more than what a car normally is, I don't want it to wear out in a couple of years. I want this thing to last at least 4 or 5 years. I want a million miles out of it. And I personally believe it would not be that much more expensive. And a mobility company, however you want to define that, will be willing to spend more up front if it knows the total overall cost is going to be less. I still believe you're right that we're going to see the replacement cycle come faster, but I think we're going to see, especially those designing cars specifically, purpose-built vehicles for ride-sharing, hailing, and whatever, are going to have to design vehicles that last a lot longer.
And you may be right, and one of the things that may come with that is you need beefier parts that can withstand a million miles. Beefier parts probably brings with it a trade-off on weight, which brings a trade-off on fuel economy, and now you're chasing the CAFE rules again. So
weight and or more exotic materials that cost more that get you the strength without adding too much weight, right?
Yeah, I'm familiar with for example, a spring company is looking at replacing leaf springs with composite springs that, you know, take 30 or 40 pounds out of the vehicle. So there's a lot of innovation coming at us. And CAFE is just such a clunky way of trying to control the fuel economy, which is one of the many cost estimates that people make when they buy a vehicle. And the other thing about CAFE is it doesn't bear any relation to reality. It's also, how many electric cars did you make? And so we're going to give you a credit for those. And so the number you end up with is a calculated creature with a whole lot of adds and deducts that you know, probably don't reflect anybody's particular driving experience.
The one job that's never in jeopardy in the auto industry is mathematician, right?
Yeah. You know, I agree with you about the need for a gas tax, and that would be way better than this Byzantine collection of regulations that we have. And I gave up writing editorials about this a decade ago because a gas tax, as you know, is the third rail in politics.
Well,
and anyone who says, hey, let's raise the gas tax, is going to get slaughtered at the polls.
Well, I know that. I mean, and that's a real problem with our government is democracy, gosh darn it.
So to John's point, I mean, is something, CAFE, better than nothing, the non-existent gas tax?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, I mean, gas tax is the right way to try and reduce the carbon footprint of, you know, transportation generally. And, I mean, in Europe, it's been hugely successful in driving a very different model for what people will buy. And that's the way it should be. But, the CAFE rule is so riddled with exceptions and workarounds and all that it's the one thing it does. It drives down the profitability of making a small fuel-efficient vehicle and drives up the profitability of having to restrict your production of larger vehicles. And so the tension is between cheap gas, which is a public policy, and then CAFE trying to force the manufacturers to drive their mix down into an area that the market really doesn't want. And I think we are crazy.
So when you talk about cheap gas, are you saying that it's as a policy being kept cheap, or it's just that, are we not paying all the costs because our gas tax is so low? It's like, what, 18 or 19 cents a gallon?
Well, there's a whole lot of things to go with a gas tax. I mean, one is, consumption of gasoline means emissions.
Yeah.
That's got a big environmental impact. It does mean at the margin you either import oil products or you export less. That's got a balance of payments effect.
Right.
And so if you want the public to behave differently because there are social costs to the consumption of gasoline, well, then tax it is the, you know, is the right social answer.
And it seems to me that from my point of view, it's like the proponents of gas tax, not talking about anybody here, of a higher gas tax, are maybe not making that clear that that there's a cost we're not paying for the cheap gas, rather than this is just a policy, this is just a way to get people to behave differently, which is when a tax becomes a four-letter word to most politicians, I think. I think that point yeah. probably needs to be more forthcoming in those who argue in favor of a higher gas tax.
I don't think so, Todd. I think that a gas tax is so visceral to so many people, and it affects their wallet every single week.
Yeah.
They see prices posted on almost every single street corner. They're so hyper aware of the price. And if you come and say, well, look, we have to offset these environmental and balance and payments and other issues, they go, yeah, but I'm paying more at the pump.
Well, yeah, environmental issues, that's one thing. But when you start to talk about infrastructure, when you talk about how bad our roads are, and obviously Michigan.
And here's the other, they don't believe that money will go to fix the roads.
No.
If you say we're going to raise the tax and we're going to fix the infrastructure, they just don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been trained not to believe what the politicians are telling them.
That's true.
And to Steve's point about the costs in European countries of gas taxes being so high. So the number here, of course, I have it.
All right.
18.4 cents per gallon is the gas tax in the United States. And it's been the
federal.
And it's been the same since 1993.
And it's higher for diesel.
It's still. So the national average that people pay all in, okay, state taxes and federal tax, 52.12 cents per gallon. That's it.
So I would say in Europe it's at least, depending on the country, $3 to $4 of taxes per gallon. Of course, there it's euros per liter, but
So, Steve, you do business all around the world. I mean, so are the demands that car companies that are based in Europe, in terms of the products that IAC provides, you do a lot of interior trims and things like that. Do they really focus on all the, the grams of weight and that sort of thing? And here it isn't as much.
Well, one thing, most of our customers have global platforms, and so they want consistency across the globe. But they care deeply about the weight. They care deeply here in the U.S. because they're chasing CAFE. They care deeply in Europe because the customers there want fuel efficiency. So we have a big R&D center over here in Troy where we are working on, getting the plastic ever thinner, yet more durable, more color fast, softer to the touch, and all of that. And that's all because weight has become such an important part of the customer's calculation of the value that we bring.
Mm-hmm.
So, from one region to another, we don't see any difference because customer wants same process, same product across the globe.
Well, and to kind of follow that up or perhaps counter it, depending on what you say, I'm assuming that GM is one of your customers.
Oh, yeah.
How have their demands for your interior trim products changed, if at all, since getting out of the European market generally with Opel and Vauxhall?
Well, we'd sold a lot to Opel as well, and that was kind of a rude shock to us when Kiefer called me up and said, hey, we're...
And PSA's not picking up that business.
We've to our pleasant surprise, we've now picked up a lot of PSA business to continue serving the former Opel products. But, again, this hasn't changed GM. GM is, bigger in China than it is here in the U.S. When I look back at when I started in this business, if somebody had told me that was going to happen, I said, oh, come on, God, you're kidding me. But it is a fact of life today. I mean, they're two big nodes, and they pretty much want consistency across the globe when they approach us. And our other big ones are Ford and FCA, Volvo, Jaguar Land Rover, BMW, VW, Daimler. I just opened up a new plant in Czech Republic to make 15,000 door panels a day for Mercedes.
15,000 a day?
15,000 door panels a day.
That's a lot of door panels.
Oh, yeah. And what the automaker, I mean, it used to be, the automaker would call, you know, five different suppliers and say, what's your price, period, end of story. Now they are much more focused on your technical ability to help them meet, you know, weight and durability and elegance demands on logistics. You know, I want it just in time. I don't want excess inventory, and I don't want to go into a cold sweat if the rail line breaks down or something. I want you to build your plant right next to my plant so that I can have it. And then reliability. I don't want 90% of them to be perfect. I want 100% of the products you send me to be perfect. And so those are three things that are very different from the old mantra of price.
I have just, you know, covering the auto industry from the point of view of an enthusiast magazine, going back to the bankruptcy year, 2009, and you know, that era before and after. I kept reading in Ward's and Automotive News and, you know, everywhere that the suppliers were getting beat up so badly, how could they make money anymore? And, of course, nobody was making money back then. But how has that changed since, say, 2010, or has it not changed?
It has changed, and for the reasons I said, that price is just not the top thing that we talk about anymore. We do talk about price. We have to compete. I mean, if somebody else can produce an almost equivalent product cheaper than we can, mm-hmm. Well, then we're going to lose that business.
But so that means price still is an issue, right? I mean, you have to come in at a low end of cost.
But they don't just want to hear your price.
Yeah.
They want to know, are you going to get it to me reliably? You're going to get it to me with quality, and you're going to be able to do it just in time. I have factories where we get, like when we serve Volvo up in our plant in Sweden, we do instrument panels. They give me 4 hours notice as to when the car is coming down the line, and only at that point do they tell me I want it gray or brown or black, I want it metric or imperial, I want it left-hand drive or right-hand drive, I want this kind of a navigation system, I want this kind of entertainment system, blah, blah, blah. The number of combinations is such that you cannot build ahead. You have to assemble it in your plant and get it over to their plant 4 hours.
Is that connected at all to Geely's ownership? Because I've heard and read about the Chinese factories, and maybe this is especially true in the tech industry more than the, you know, computers and so on rather than auto industry, but that one thing that China's been able to do beside the low cost when manufacturing things is being able to change very quickly within a factory when the demand suddenly changes one way or another. Has that always been the case for Volvo, or has that come along since the Geely ownership?
Well, I've only been dealing with them for 3 years when I came to IAC, and Geely was already in place there, but they were struggling to get their just-in-time systems right, and we were struggling to get ours right. So we've now got it running smoothly. It was a little bit perky-jerky when I first came on the scene, and we were both,
But it became kind of a synergy in that you were both trying to get to the same goal at the same time.
Now going way back in my history in the car business, at Chrysler, we used to try and figure out why the Japanese were making money and we couldn't and so on. And one of the secrets was when the Japanese would build a car plant, they would build in the flexibility to move with the market one way or another. Yeah, it might have a variable cost penalty, but it meant that whenever the market shifted a little bit, you didn't have to pour in another $1 billion to fix the factory. Mm-hmm. Whereas I would say the mentality that I grew up in, at first at Ford Motor where I worked and then at Chrysler where I worked, each a dozen years each, our mentality was do everything you can to get the variable cost down to the minimum. And if the market shifted a little bit, okay, let's throw another billion into the factory and we'll still have low variable costs. The Japanese would accept a slightly higher variable cost of production in order to have the flexibility. And I assume that must be part of the Asian mentality. And hopefully we've learned lessons from them and are now able to do the same.
You know, it's interesting. Hey,
we got to take a quick commercial break. Hold your thought. We'll be right back. But first, a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. Out of line after hours, talking with Steve Miller, the president and CEO of IAC. And I rudely cut you off.
Well, not at all,
Gary.
So this is interesting. So you were talking about the flexibility of manufacturing that existed in the Japanese plants. And one of your original points when the show opened was talking, you know, we were talking about Ford and how the other companies have come out and said, you know, we're going to continue. And I'm going to destroy his name, but Henio Arcangeli Jr., who's a senior VP of automotive for Honda, said when they announced their numbers yesterday, our flexible manufacturing capabilities allow us to evolve our production mix in real time to meet these continued shifts in consumer demand. So basically saying we're going to continue to make a variety of vehicles, trucks and cars and SUVs and crossovers, because we have flexible manufacturing. So it's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, it's another creature, by the way, of if your labor costs are high, then you want to try and make everything automated, and that doesn't really lend itself to making pickups one day and cars the next. You have to focus on a particular line. But I just think being self-critical of, you know, my time in the OE business at Ford and at Chrysler, we were excessively focused on minimal variable cost, and then, you know, and then on some other ledger there was all the investments that it took to drive that.
Hey, you got a number?
Oh yeah, forget about that.
Okay, time for Dr. Data. This is always the part of the program where Gary brings up a number and we got to guess what the heck it means.
Okay, so we haven't talked about this on this show, but we have on other shows that there's this, you know, possible concern that maybe young people are not going to be quite as interested in automobiles as some of us that are older have been over time. And so I was thinking about that. And so, Katie, could you bring up the first number, please? So since 2013, 90 million units have been sold of this, which represents $6 billion in sales.
The U.S., globally? Are we supposed to guess?
Globally.
Okay.
90 million units, and this is an automotive product.
It's an automotive-related product.
Ah, related.
It has something to do with people's interest in cars. Perhaps not in a very good way, but an interest in cars. I thought those were pretty impressive numbers.
Well, that seems like too low a number to be a smartphone, if that's what you're getting at.
That's not a smartphone.
Yeah. Automotive-related
John's
product.
John's busy trying to see what that image is.
Yeah, because usually the image behind, which is hard to make out, can be a clue.
Yeah.
And, boy, I'm stumped. I have no idea.
Sean's smiling back there.
Sean knows what it is?
He thinks this is a funny one.
He said globally.
And the answer is Grand Theft Auto V, the most financially successful media title of all time, according to MarketWatch. See, so you got all those kids are playing that, racing these cars around and doing perhaps not good things, but here you go. It's a lot of video games sold.
Well, same like, you know, if you buy the Madden game, you're not going to become an NFL player. So I wouldn't expect to convert these people to actually driving cars or stealing, I hope.
There you go.
Hey, we've got some questions coming in here. Steve, I'm going to throw them at you kind of rapid fire. George Jin says, or asks, whose life is better? An auto manufacturer who has millions of customers or an auto supplier that maybe has a dozen?
I would say it's easier to be an auto supplier. I think the job of an auto manufacturer having to make, you know, thousands of motor vehicles a day, each one of them with 5,000 parts that all have to arrive on time. It's one of the miracles of human organization that it actually works relatively flawlessly every day.
Yeah. Interesting. Mark Kay says, what's your view on GM Korea? What's going to happen there?
Well, from what I read, GM, you know, finally reached a settlement with the union that allows them to move forward rather than just shutting the operation down. So I'm happy for both sides that they were able to find an accommodation. But it looked like they were going to just shut it down, and that was kind of discouraging that GM would end up being just a two-country player.
Yeah. Is GM Korea a customer of yours?
We actually don't. Well, I don't even know. Yeah, okay. We don't make stuff in Korea, so I'm not quite sure where they procure it.
Okay. And just Andy G says, are affordable fuel-efficient cars dying out in the U.S., or is this just Ford?
Well, I think, I mean, what I've seen in the U.S. is every small car has been under pressure. You've seen GM cutting back on shifts and cutting back on volumes. Ford was doing the same thing. Chrysler got out of the smaller car business altogether. So I think there's a lot of pressure on the Detroit 3. But as was pointed out earlier, some of the other manufacturers are picking up the slack to the extent there's still a demand for smaller, more affordable, fuel-efficient vehicles.
They are picking up the slack, but passenger car sales continue to plummet.
Yeah.
And they last month, they dropped by another 100,000-plus yeah. units. We haven't even seen the bottom of up yet.
And now, just going way back in my history, when I started with Ford Motor, the reports every 10 days, that's another subject, it's frequency
of
reporting.
We'll get to that in a sec.
The reports every 10 days were always car sales and pickup trucks and other non-sedans were totally ignored. It just didn't even register on screen. And we, Chrysler, then in the 1980s, we were making as many trucks, quote-unquote, as cars, but the market shares were always focused on the car business. So today, where the big three in Detroit are getting out of the car business, is what a sea change that has been. Because the light passenger vehicles are now largely registered as trucks.
What do you make of GM dropping monthly sales?
Well, I think getting out of 10-day sales is a good idea because that was overly distracting. And, did the 10th day come on a Saturday or a Sunday or a Easter holiday or whatever? Kind of gets you all confused. But monthly, I think, is the right tempo. And GM might not report it, but you got so many states who report vehicle registrations that it'll be tractable. And the only thing, if you don't report it, somebody else will and probably get it wrong.
Why do you think they dropped it?
I don't know. The conspiracy theory is that they were getting embarrassed by market share declines here and there. But I don't personally know why they did. And I just think it was a mistake. I think that a normal tempo, it's very useful information for all kinds of purposes beyond the automobile business. It's kind of the pulse on the economy. And to be denied that information, I think, is not good for all of us.
I agree. And not getting the information from the biggest player in the market still.
Well, I wonder if there's a little of what I call a Tesla effect here, that Tesla's reaction to how it reports sales is that, if we report, some cars might have been bought just before or just after the month ends, and what does that matter? You're delivering more. What matters is you get a better picture looking at a longer period of time. And I think maybe GM was looking at that to a certain extent. And frankly, I think the effect will be in fairly quick time that everybody else will go to GM and not the other way, not GM coming back. That is, others will drop and go to quarterly.
See, but I wonder, reports. You know, if General Motors is out of the conversation, so there's a monthly conversation that people have in terms of what car sales are and how they're doing and what's up and what's down and what's hot and what's not, right? Mm-hmm. And now General Motors is not part of that. They're only going to be part of that quarterly. So isn't that actually detrimental to their sales going forward? Because, you know, there's so much media saturation and there are so many people that are talking about things like that. And you're getting, you know, tech publications that are suddenly now interested in the car business that never were interested before. And there's no General Motors. And so if General Motors doesn't do something to make news, no one's going to talk about it.
I think there's one other thing going on, and that's that, and I'm not necessarily trying to defend its decision, but I can see why GM decided to do this. If you look at, for all the talk about cutting fleet sales, right, and we get reports monthly now saying that, oh, our total sales were down, but our retail sales are up, that a lot of the high volume models are affected by fleet sales, and that depends on, you know, did I deliver, you know, 10,000 Chevy Cruzes or Ford Fusions to Hertz this month? That has a lot more to do with who's up and who's down than many other things. The cars we care about, frankly, are the very low volume cars that are just kind of bouncing along at 1,000 or 2,000 per month anyway. So I think it has a lot to do with that, too.
Steve, you had mentioned before, you know, this industry is sailing into uncharted waters with the connectivity and electrification. Let's talk electric cars a minute.
Let's talk about Tesla.
Okay.
and here's the point. My son lives here in the Detroit area and runs a internet-type company. And he and I debate all the time whether Elon Musk is, you know, the reincarnation of the Holy Spirit, or is he
a charlatan?
A charlatan. And what we've found so far is that the business of producing cars in volume is really tough. Okay, and so you have to have some residual admiration for the Detroit 3 and the traditional automakers. He has done a wonderful job, hasn't made any money yet, even though the government has subsidized his factories, has subsidized training his workforce, and subsidizes all of his customers, you know, and yet still hasn't proven that he can make money. He's been a fashion success. Everybody who's anybody wants to have one and show it off in the neighborhood, including my son, who bought one last month, and he's proud to show me that. And
so he got it.
He got
a Model 3 or a Model 3?
Yeah, Model 3, oh. And he thinks, you know, that Elon Musk and those like him are going to take over the world. And I debate with him at times as to whether his generation, you know, someday will be driving Apples and Googles instead of Chevys and Fords. I mean, because, you know, are the people who manufacture the hardware going to rule the world, or are the people who manufacture the software, the brains of these vehicles, rule the world? And that's very interesting. And I think the jury's out as to whether electric vehicles will be successful. You have they are simpler with fewer parts, but the batteries, you know, I would have thought by now that battery technology would have made a major breakthrough
cost.
The effectiveness of carrying your energy around in a package in the vehicle. Right now, gasoline is far and away the simplest, easiest way to package energy so that you can go, you know, 300-500 miles. And, you know, with electrification, yeah, it's cleaner emissions, but the environmental impact is somewhere else where the electricity is being generated, not right at the tailpipe. And okay, but I don't know if electrification is going to take over the world. The Chinese have decreed it. It's going to be interesting to see whether they stick with that. And maybe, you know, just that sheer pressure will drive the technological advances that are needed to make electric vehicles, you know, a rousing success with all customers.
So let me ask you, Steve, given your history in this industry, so back in the day when you were at, say, Chrysler, and there was some small automotive manufacturer, Lotus, let's say, I mean, that just made a handful of cars. I mean, would you guys have paid any attention to them?
Let me tell you, I started out in a market or product analysis group in the glass house down in Dearborn in the finance staff, and we made all kinds of reports about product comparisons, price comparisons, you know, sales comparisons, everything for three competitors. We ignored the Japanese in the entirety. They weren't even part of our mindset of what we looked at. And it's because the big three dominated, you know, the business of selling vehicles to the American public. And so to me, I'm just amazed at how the world has changed. But no, I mean, Lotus, are you kidding?
Right.
We didn't even pay any attention to Volkswagen.
So, I mean, it's just like, I'm you know, Tesla gets so much discussion, and in all things considered, they're not even a Camry's month worth of sales.
That's right. And, yeah, they are not equal to, you know, a month's worth of production out of a GM plant. Yeah. And yet, you know, the world thinks, okay, they've arrived. And, you know, more power to Elon Musk is, you know, managing public perception. But he is yet to prove that he can deliver, you know, a high volume production to match the, you know, market expectation.
Well, hold on. I want to come back to this because this is really good. But we got to take another commercial break right now and give a great shout out to our great sponsor, Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking all things automotive with Steve Miller, and you guys were about to jump in on Tesla.
I was just about to say that he's got the attention of Wall Street, which accounts for a lot. I mean, we're talking about people for whom a car is something you hail or has a little light up on top that says taxi. As small as it is, it's got a market cap bigger than Ford and for a while was bigger than GM. I've said this before, but from my point of view, it's that you have Wall Street and maybe Silicon Valley thinking that the future will be electric cars, and when that becomes the future, the company that's building nothing but electric cars will do better than the companies that are building conventional ICE cars that are paying for the electric cars now. Nothing's paying for his – he doesn't have any ICEs to pay for the electric cars. We see that as being, you know, unfathomable, something you can't sustain, and yet Wall Street believes that as long as we keep shoveling money into it, sooner or later, it will turn out to be become the leader.
See, but I say take the whole money conversation out of it, okay? And I'm betting dollars to donuts, Steve's son didn't buy a Tesla because he knew or didn't know whether Elon's making money. He probably did, but sake of argument. I mean, he just bought it because it was a car. Because it was a car, it was desirable. So forget about the finances, forget about Wall Street, forget about all that stuff, right? And so here it is, it's a car and nothing more, nothing less, but somehow it's got pixie dust that makes it more of a desirable car, seemingly.
It's a fashion statement right now.
By the way, does he own any other cars?
He had a Infiniti, which he traded in.
Oh,
I mean, Infiniti SUV, by the way.
So he's dependent only on the Tesla Model 3 for getting around, because I think is probably true that most Model S and Model X owners have two or three or four or five or more cars in their driveway or in their garage, not in their driveway. And when Tesla has to pick it up and work on it, and, you know, helicopter in to work on the car, you've something else to choose from. So it's interesting that, and that's what the Model 3 is supposed to be, a car for people who can't necessarily afford more than one or two cars. So it's interesting that he fits that category.
That's what I've heard is that, you know, most of the Tesla buyers are very upscale and multiple car ownership in the family. So, okay, if it doesn't suit us today, we'll just drive the other thing.
Yeah.
But see, I have a lot of respect for what Tesla has achieved. I mean, they've gone to number one in cars that cost over $100,000. They have brushed aside Mercedes, BMW, and Audi in this respect. They have 450,000 people still waiting in line to get the Tesla Model 3.
Well, we think. We don't know how many there was.
Well, you know, whether or not, you know, I don't know where the exact number is now. It's still big. I personally believe that if Elon wasn't such a jerk and had not overpromised so much and had listened to the people who are seemingly leaving the company in droves right now and underpromised and done things right, they would be a profitable company right now. If they had launched the Model 3 and hit the targets that they thought they would have, I think it'd be a very profitable company. I am alarmed by how he berates his suppliers, calling them more worthless than a drunken sloth, to quote him. He fires hundreds of line workers, you know, just saying that they're lazy. As I've said, he's got very top talent people leaving the company. Yesterday, he laid into a couple of the analysts who asked some fairly probing financial questions about the company and spent most of the rest of the analyst call with some guy who's got his own YouTube channel who's definitely a Tesla fanboy who just kept lobbing up softballs for
him. He's not only a guy. He is a kid. He's pretty young.
He's a young guy. Hey, look, I'm not knocking the guy. More power to him for getting on the call. Yeah. But I'm just saying, when Elon gets pressured by somebody on what I think are very legitimate questions, it's like, oh, you're boring. I'm cutting you off. Let's talk to somebody who's just going to lob softballs.
Well, and the second that he cut off was Joe Spak of RBC, who was trying to get to the crux of how many of the reservations for the Model 3 have been configured on your website. So in other words, how many of those 450,000 are still, you know, looking to get a car, and how many have dropped out and bought a Chevy Bolt or just gone elsewhere?
See, we won't know because Chevy won't release those numbers.
Yeah. we won't know for 3 months at least, or 2 months left.
All right. Sorry, go ahead, Gary.
No, I was going to say, I want to move to a different topic, and this is something that I know that you're very interested in. So, Steve, one of the companies that you worked at was Hawker Beechcraft.
Yes.
Aircraft. So John believes that we're going to have flying drones. Passenger drones. What's your sense of that?
Well, that was a dream when I was a kid. Everybody'd be, you know, flying around the neighborhood in their own little private plane, but I still think it's a long way to go, just because of the increased risk. You know, if you're in a car and it doesn't quite work right, you can pull over to the curb and get out and check the tires or whatever you do. If you're in an airplane, you cannot, you know, just pull over to the curb. You're going to crash if it malfunctions. And I think to create a personal vehicle like that is safe is, you know, 50 years down the road.
We'll see. I think it's sooner than that.
I'd hate to see what air traffic control is going to be like.
It will be its own air traffic control. That's what they're shooting for. You know, DARPA, the FAA, and NASA are the ones pushing this. So I'm going by what they're saying, not just me. But we talked about electric cars, a little bit about passenger drones. What is your view about autonomy? And especially as you get into ride sharing, are we going to see people increasingly decide, I'm not going to buy a car. I don't need a car. I just whip out my phone and get a ride to come to me.
Yeah. Well, it depends on, do people really care that the car has been, you know, in use already, you know, 10 hours today, you know, and four other people or families were in there and they spilled their, you know, food and drink on the floor and all that. I mean, how do you, when you get in your own car in your own garage, it's as clean as you want it to be. When it's, you know, is the rideshare going to be more like getting into a New York City taxi cab, which is usually disgusting? That's one question. But some more questions. One, are we going to have our conventional system of roads and highways, or are there going to be dedicated freeways that will handle efficiently and safely large volumes of autonomous vehicles, but and be prohibited from having, hand-driven cars on the road, which are where the danger is. The human driver is far more dangerous than the autonomous vehicle is designed to be. Another thing is you could actually, if you had an autonomous vehicle and you're in a big urban environment and for which there's usually a big problem of trying to find a place to park, actually, you know, go to where you want to go, get out and tell your car to go park yourself, so to speak. And it can go away and park in a wherever there's a parking area that may have nothing to do with the building that you're going into. So, those open a lot of different ways of thinking about personal transportation. I do think it will come, and it'll probably come a lot sooner than I'm willing to admit in my stodgy old advanced age.
Steve, as a supplier of interior parts, I mean, is IAC looking at this issue of, you know, the family of four that had been in the vehicle before and now there's somebody else in it and you know, coming up with different approaches to addressing what we're used to?
We are, you know, there's two big trends we've talked about. One is electrification. That doesn't matter. I mean, it's an electric vehicle still needs seats. It is still a driver-centric cockpit arrangement, everybody facing forward. Autonomous vehicles completely changes what you need for interiors. That's now more like a mobile living room. You know, you don't have to all be facing forward. You can be in a club design where you're all looking at each other. You can play cards or have a nice chat along the way. The comfort, the whole way the interior is designed. One of the things we're experimenting with is, so is this going to, if some people are looking backwards instead of straight forward, are they going to get nauseous in the car? Can you overcome that with the way the car smells? And so on. I mean, there's a lot of innovation in the interior design and materials and everything else that's driven by the fact that it's autonomous rather than driver-controlled.
Are you guys working on trying to design these new interiors?
Yeah.
Are you guys dealing with smells?
Yeah.
So, I mean, okay.
How do you do it? We have, you know, these advanced research labs, and my competitors all do, too. If you go to a Faurecia or Grupo Antolin or Yanfeng, product show, you will see the same thing of their focus on the future of interiors. It's got lighting, it's going to be lighting. The advances in creative lighting are really something to make things beautiful, and they glow in the dark and everything. So it's the world is changing, and we'll be able to keep up with, as fast as the automobile makers start producing autonomous vehicles in volume, we'll be there with them to help them.
That's amazing about smell, though. I've not heard that.
Yeah.
I've heard of lighting being able to create a horizon so that people facing backwards are not getting nauseous. What's with the smell that prevents that?
Well, I mean, it's just something we're tinkering with in the back room to see whether you can overcome what would otherwise be a nausea situation by having the smell be different than it ordinarily is.
Are you talking about like perfumes or flowery smells or something else altogether?
Yeah, well, we're trying to find out what will reduce
popcorn. Popcorn's going to be the answer of the future.
Yeah, can you coffee? You give me coffee. That'll keep you awake.
Cinnabon.
Can you talk about you do work for GM? You do supply to GM. Can you talk about whether you're doing anything with the cars they plan mass produce next year, the Chevy Bolt based car with no steering wheel and no pedals?
No, where we're focused, like them, is on where they make money, like the SUVs. We're in the process of building a new factory down in Arlington, Texas, to supply all their, the Tahoes and Escalades and all that.
Is that new business for you, that you're building a plant?
Yeah, well, it's we've been doing a lot of that business now, but we've roughly doubling our content on the SUVs that they make down in Arlington.
Oh, okay.
Great business.
And why did we get that business? is they wanted logistics. They wanted to be sure we could get the product to them on time. And so rather than shipping from a distance, we're going to make them right there next door to their factory. So their EVPs, my longtime friend Steve Kiefer, head of purchasing, and Senator Ted Cruz and a bunch of other officials did all the groundbreaking down there at Arlington last year.
Oh, you got some big names out for your plant.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about, of all your plants, can you give us a percentage or a portion that are next to your, that close to your customer?
Yeah, we have 50 factories around the globe. Mm-hmm. In every major continent. I don't think we're in Antarctica yet, but you know, someday. And the general rule of thumb for the products we make is to be within 100 miles of the automotive assembly plant customer. And the reason for that, if you think of an instrument panel, it is big, it is fragile. It's got a lot of air in it, so it doesn't nest conveniently. You have to protect it as it, you know, goes over a bumpy road on a truck. And when you put all that together, even without just-in-time, you really can't afford to be very far away. So ours is not a product you can say, I'm going to serve the world by making them all in Thailand, okay? That can't happen. And it's just way too expensive to ship. The logistics are the thing. So most of our factories are, I say, a rule of thumb, within 100 miles of the assembly plant customer. And that's the reason why we have 50 of them instead of 10.
This will be my very ignorant question about the kind of the history of auto suppliers. Was there ever a point where, was there a shift from a point where you had a factory that might do products for a couple of different automakers, and when did that shift happen? Was that before the...
Well, we do have a number of plants that have multiple automotive customers.
Yeah.
But that would be a creature of the fact that the two or three automakers have factories nearby.
Okay. All right.
Hey, we're getting down to the end of the show here. I wanted to acknowledge some of the people who had written in before we wrap it up. But George in Sunnyvale, going back to our Tesla discussion, says he lives in Silicon Valley, and the majority of owners have two or three other cars. Yeah. They also do all their charging at the Tesla charging facilities. Let's see. Ian Hendry said this about electric cars. He says Audi, their quality department, focuses on some 500 different functions for a gasoline-powered car. With an electric car, there's something like 100,000 different electrical signals that it has to monitor from a quality standpoint. Kind of interesting point. Ian Hendry says, I think the problem with the longevity of ride-sharing cars is the problem of interiors wearing out. They got to figure out a way to keep it looking fresh and as well as mechanically safe. So that's echoing what you said. And there's some other questions. Maybe we'll get to them next week because they're asking questions that we didn't get into in today's discussion. But, Steve, I know you got to run to the airport, so we're going to have to wrap this show up now. Thank you for coming on Autoline After Hours and sharing this great wealth of information that you have. Great having you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Good deal. Todd Lassa, thanks for coming over. Really good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks again.
Gary, always good to do a show with you.
Thank you. Next week.
And of course, we want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.